50 years ago, US President Richard Nixon called a press conference to declare drug abuse, quote, America's public enemy number one, end quote. Quickly dubbed the war on drugs, Nixon's campaign aimed to stop illegal drug use and distribution by dramatically increasing prison sentences for both dealers and users. Five decades on, the war on drugs is widely considered a failure. Despite this, the war on drugs still has a ripple effect around the globe, including in New Zealand, where our own policy has been influenced by it. Sarah Helm is the Executive Director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation. She joins the program now. Sarah, kia ora.
Asmarie.
Ngā mihi nui kia koe e hoa.
Kia ora.
So this started in 1971. What was happening at the time Nixon kicked off the war on drugs in Aotearoa?
Yeah, so there'd been a number of things happen over the course of that century, actually leading up to 1971. But Nixon, after that press conference, later in history, one of his key aides at the time during that press conference and his subsequent declaration of war on drugs, he came out and said that, in actual fact, the primary enemy of the Nixon campaign had been two groups, African Americans and the anti-war left. And he claims that actually they ramped up the war on drug effort, or created the war on drug effort, in order to clamp down on those two groups, because you couldn't criminalise being African American and you couldn't criminalise having anti-war views. But by really focusing the cannabis and heroin associations with those two groups and criminalising that activity, they were able to sort of go in and raid the homes of the leaders and undertake a whole lot of activity they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. That sort of thought is a little bit disputed. So some people say that perhaps that was an exaggeration. That particular aide had been done some prison time for Watergate before he said that. But nonetheless, it does seem like, I mean, Nixon actually for a period of time put cannabis into what is their version in the States of classification A. So cannabis was made a Class A drug for a period of time in the States. And so that seems like a pretty extreme measure to be taking against that particular drug.
John Ehrlichman is the aide that you're talking about.
Oh, yes, thank you. And yes, I can't say his last name, so I'm very grateful.
It's all good. And you're right, it appears that this was more criminalisation of his political foes and enemies as opposed to the criminalisation of drugs. And I think it was Jimmy Carter who became president after Gerald Ford who tried to peg a bit of that back. In fact, the states tried to peg a bit of what Nixon tried to do back. But Reagan came in 1980, and then all of a sudden you've seen greater activity, greater imprisonment of those who were partaking of cannabis at the time. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, during that period, just after Nixon, as you're saying, 11 states in the United States had decriminalised cannabis. So it's hard to believe now, because we've had such a long period of viewing the illegality of that drug as being very important. But actually, for a period of time, it was decriminalised. And you're quite right, Reagan then ramped it up even further. We have seen, you know, mass incarceration of Latino and African Americans and a huge number of other problems as a result.
That zero tolerance policy that Reagan had at the time, the old just say no, right, during the 1980s, they used to say. I mean, even Clinton ran on a campaign of not necessarily decriminalising, but taking a different approach to drug reform, and in the end didn't do anything, which is kind of ironic, given his quote of, you know, I did not inhale and all that kind of stuff. But what was New Zealand? I mean, this is essentially the US exported, right? It's war on drugs, it's drug policy around the world. How did New Zealand respond, and why did New Zealand follow the trend?
Yeah, quite right. So all of the restrictions that we've placed, virtually all of the restrictions we've placed in New Zealand on substance use have been imported ones, primarily driven by the United States and international conventions. We, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and actually before that, before the colonisers and settlers arrived, Māori didn't tend to, we don't think, use any mind-altering substances. So they came over with colonisation. Of course, alcohol and tobacco are the most famous. But cocaine, heroin, cannabis and opium were fairly widely available in the late 1800s and early 1900s, which perhaps is less widely known. And we implemented a number of things during the 1900s that were imported. But before that, we created our own, or just after that, our first one was actually the 1912 Opium Convention. As a result of that international convention, New Zealand implemented a racist policy targeting Chinese New Zealanders around their opium use. But we had the Poisons Act and we had a Dangerous Drugs Act, and essentially it provided for cocaine, morphine, amphetamines, heroin and cannabis to be prescribed. And in fact, our prescription of heroin was so liberal that we had a letter sent to us in the 1950s by the United Nations really asking us to rein in our prescriptions. We also had medicinal cannabis largely being prescribed out of Auckland up until the 1950s. And what was happening in the 1950s is there's this man called Anslinger who had started out in the 1930s in the States, and he really drove their campaign for prohibition. And as you'll know, America had a huge amount of international influence. And so as their influence ramped up during the 1950s, they really got the United Nations thinking about cannabis and other drugs. And so that's where we started to tighten up our control. And in 1961, they passed the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, and we then passed a Narcotics Act, and that's when we started arresting people. So there were a handful of people being arrested before then, and then it ratcheted up to about 150. And then we moved towards the Misuse of Drugs Act. So in the lead up to the Misuse of Drugs Act, we there was this committee, the Black Palmer Committee, and they recommended getting in line with the international conventions. As you see, everything that we've done to sort of criminalise drugs has been as a result of that international pressure. At that point, that's where we created the classification system. But even that committee recommending that we bring in the classification system, which puts, you know, drug use penalties, there's some fines, but also between 3 months and life imprisonment. You can have life imprisonment for distributing Class A drugs, which I should state, for example, includes mushrooms and LSD, which are thought to be fairly low harm and not addictive. But they recommended a degree of discretion in application of the law at that point in time. The kind of thing that we've been experiencing here in New Zealand more recently. That act, the 1975 Misuse of Drugs Act, actually passed right on the eve of an election, virtually, because I guess it was not very controversial. And one of my colleagues has studied the Hansard over that time, and a lot of politicians at the time spoke about public health and wellbeing. So perhaps the intention behind the law hasn't been the experience of it. And we still have that law in place 45 years later.
Because the intention, certainly from the New Zealand Drug Foundation, is education and reform and more appropriate drug reform framework and policy in Aotearoa New Zealand. But the intention back then was to protect children from harm. So what kind of framework should be in place now, knowing that the war on drugs hasn't worked?
Yeah, so I kind of think that we've done our best in New Zealand when we've forged our own path based on evidence and our willingness to try different approaches. And we've seen that more recently in the COVID response. And we've seen it in drug harm reduction. And the two good examples that we have got of harm reduction in New Zealand, which is the needle exchange in the late 80s, 1987-1988, which decided to ignore the fact that it was illegal to have injected drug use and instead focus on reducing the harm created from, at that time, the, you know, prospect of mass infection through HIV, and instead provide for the distribution of clean injecting equipment to injected drug users. And more recently in drug checking, and that particular more recent activity allows us to reduce the potential harm of unknown substances, people taking unknown substances and getting really hurt as a result. So I think we can do better than in imported ideas that we've brought over. But we do have some great international examples emerging. And 20 years ago, Portugal decriminalised drug use. They've focused on health and harm reduction instead. And as a result, they have had HIV infections, hepatitis infections, and overdose rates just drop dramatically. And you also haven't seen a corresponding increase in use. There's sort of an idea that decriminalising means encouraging drug use, but actually it's been fairly proven now that convictions do nothing to deter use. And also studies have shown, and experience has now shown, that decriminalising doesn't increase use, but what it does do is it allows you to deal with harm. And that's what the Drug Foundation's COPUP is all about. We're about reducing the harm of drugs.
Dealing with this as a health issue has been the foundational kind of basis and approach.
Yeah.
There are other parts of the world that have, I mean, Canada's looked at this already, obviously. You've got states in Australia, I think New South Wales is one, ACT might be another, who are considering the issue now. We obviously had the referendum last year and we know what the result of that referendum was. Where are we placed by comparison to the rest of the world in terms of that drug reform work that you say is required? Are we behind other parts of the world?
Look, I think we're starting to fall behind. We have seen, I mean, just on my way here, it seems like every other week there is a new state or country that passes drug law reform. And just on my way here, I read about Maine have just passed a drug decriminalisation legislation. So we have now in the States a Biden-Harris administration that are taking a really different line on drugs. They have incorporated intentionally racial equality and harm reduction into the principles of the way they govern things. And 17 states across America have now legalised cannabis. And we now have at least two states that have decriminalised drug use. And they have there's a piece of legislation actually at that federal level looking at decriminalisation of all drugs and expunging people's records. Those records have a huge impact on people's lives. But yeah, as you say, we have other countries. So Canada has legalised cannabis. They're looking at a discretion kind of an amendment for other use. Mexico and Malta have legalised and decriminalised cannabis and a number of other places. So it does seem like we are at risk of falling behind and we definitely could do better.
In 2019, I think it was, we passed the Misuse of Drugs Amendment Act, which I think gave police greater discretion in the way in which they approach this issue. Have we not seen any tangible kind of results or change in the way police use discretion when it comes to this kind of issue?
We have seen some results, and I wouldn't want to say that we haven't seen any, but what we are seeing is a really divergent application of the law. So the New Zealand Herald, Derek Cheng, did a great OAA this week and showed just the huge variances in different areas and the different districts where the law is being enforced and different rates of people being still criminalised and prosecuted. So, and the variance really tells the story that there is a huge amount of interpretation of the law involved. So, but basically, the district commander and the arresting officer has to have a think about whether or not it's whether the person would benefit from a health approach and whether or not it's in the public interest to pursue one. And it's quite a big, you know, there's a big room for sort of thought around there, and it's not necessarily their specialist skill. We think the law needs to be a lot clearer. It particularly needs to be clearer for people who use drugs, because we want people to be able to have honest conversations about their use, to be able to get help and advice, and to be able to get help and advice before they form an an addiction or come to the attention of the law, we could do better preventing addiction and preventing additional harms by allowing for a more honest interpretation of the law. So that's what we want to see. We're also still seeing huge numbers of people being convicted. We're still seeing cannabis use and possession charges, for example, but also we're seeing actually an increase in methamphetamine charges for people who have, you know, that very low-level charges, possession and use. And while that may seem like a good thing, because people have been, we've been taught for decades that by banning drugs, it's the right thing to do, and that'll dissuade people. But we know from decades of evidence it's not true. So what we're doing is taking the people who are potentially experiencing the most harm from one of the more harmful drugs and piling convictions on them instead of offering them assistance and help. And that's what we think we should be doing, and that's what the evidence says we should be doing.
But of course, we had the referendum last year. I mean, surely this has had an impact. Sorry, the referendum happened last year. The New Zealand Drug Foundation supported that referendum. And of course, we had the result that we had.
Yeah.
So will we see any really meaningful change in terms of our approach to decriminalisation now, given that we've had the referendum and we are where we are?
Yeah, so the referendum's being used as shorthand for all drug reform, and it wasn't. It was a specific referendum on a specific piece of legislation which would have seen legalisation of cannabis and a particular model of that. And people voted for or against that. Many people have told me that they voted against it. But the ones that have told me for very specific reasons, because they didn't like a commercial model or some other aspect. It wasn't shorthand for changing our drug laws. And so 39%, so Helen Clark Foundation ran a survey earlier this year, 39% of people who voted no actually support decriminalisation. So there's a huge amount of scope for change, even though that referendum, of course, did fail, even though it was super close and very heartbreaking from our side. And we know something has to be done. So in the last 10 years, we've had 52,000 drug convictions. And, you know, one of the most alarming things and should give us pause for thought is that 47% of all convictions are Māori. We're essentially criminalising young Māori men. And I don't really think that's an acceptable acceptable thing. We need to find some other solutions. We are spending $100 million a year prosecuting. Now, we could be spending a large chunk of that money on helping people and on providing harm reduction advice and harm reduction initiatives. We've had over 70 lives lost to synthetic cannabinoids since 2017. And whilst that's tapered off a wee bit because we've put some interventions in place, we are unable to undertake some interventions because the law prohibits them. So, for example, with synthetic cannabinoids, we think we could, for example, have a safe drug use space where supervised drug use space is done in Australia, for example. There's a few of those that have been very successful at preventing death. Mm. And it could be an intervention that helps to save lives, but the blanket criminalisation of drug use really gets in the way.
You talked about young Māori men. I think back to, I think it was 2016, a Ngaitahu relation of yours, actually, I think it was, Tuari Potiki, the former chair of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, presented to the United Nations General Assembly special session and talked about his experience. I mean, I think it took him months and months to get a visa because he has a criminal conviction from years ago, 30 years ago, I think it was, when he was younger. And he had a criminal drug conviction at the time. And he said to the special session at the UN, if there is a war to be fought, and I believe there is, it should be a war on poverty, on disparity, on dispossession, and on the multitude of political and historical factors that have left and continue to leave so many people vulnerable and in jeopardy. So how do we do that? Because that is a big bit of work that needs to be done if we're to answer the ultimate issue that Tuari talks about.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I was actually thinking about that this morning, about the huge amount of harm that's been done by colonisation and dispossession and poverty. And, you know, we have ongoing social issues that create some of the worst drug use, but and worst problems associated with drug use. But at the moment, we're essentially trying to crack a nut with a sledgehammer in terms of our drug law interventions. So about 90% of drug users, according to the UNODC, and it depends from drug to drug and in a New Zealand context, but about 90% of people who use drugs don't get addicted, about 10% do. And so we are taking this huge sort of criminalisation approach and compounding the harms on some of the people who are experiencing some of the worst, you know, worst results of some of those social issues that you're talking about. We're piling convictions on top of them as well. It's not a coincidence that Indigenous people around the world have had a very similar experience of drug harm and the harm of the criminal justice system being piled on top of their drug harm. And so we need to find a better way.
The other issue that's come up recently as a result of a couple of documentaries, or a documentary that happened this week actually, I think from Paddy Kawa, who ultimately says that we need to treat things like meth as a health issue. And a really strong response, particularly from other New Zealand personalities, or certainly New Zealand people in the media who have, you know, been at risk from people who have taken P, saying that that the community needs to be protected. But at the same time, you have, like the New Zealand Drug Foundation, saying that this needs to be dealt with as a health issue. I mean, how do you do that? How do you deal with this as a health issue and also protect the community from the adverse impacts of those who are taking meth?
Yeah, I completely empathise with all of those views. And what I think is our best example where there is a difference being made is a Northland program. It's police-led, but it's a health-based program, Te Ara Oranga, and they're using a mix of all of the different strands of our drug policy. We tend to just focus on supply control, so drug busts and arresting people, but actually in Northland, they're doing community action, they're doing harm reduction and problem limitation, demand reduction activities. They're trying to support people into employment successfully, actually, and it's making some impact. And so we have this really great, again, a New Zealand grown initiative that's actually making a difference. And we've been calling for that program to be properly funded and rolled out for years now. So we want to see that properly funded and rolled out. I had a journalist yesterday ask me, well, you know, some people think that people on P, as she calls it, methamphetamine, should be perhaps put in jail because then they have an opportunity to dry out. Well, actually, methamphetamine is more complicated than that. People need treatment and support. They relapse after coming off of it, and so they need really strong aftercare as well. And so we don't think that's a good approach. And in fact, if we take this other approach, we can prevent people from becoming addicted and prevent some of those worst harms. So, like I said before, it may feel counterintuitive to remove our sort of commitment to punitive approaches because that's going to get it under control. It's not getting it under control. That hasn't been the case.
Yeah. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
And for being a part of the program this morning. In your role as the Executive Director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, we wish you well.
Kia ora.
Kia ora maida. That was Sarah Helm, the Executive Director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation.